Chapter 14. It must not be supposed that in setting forth the memories of this half hour between the moment my uncle left my room till we met again at dinner, I am losing sight of Lemaire's folly. Having confessed that my first novel was begun in idleness, a holiday task, I think I have also given the impression that it was a much delayed book. It was never dismissed from my mind, even when the hope of ever finishing it was very faint. Many things came in its way. Daily duties, new impressions, old memories. It was not the outcome of a need, the famous need of self-expression which artists find in their search for motives. The necessity which impelled me was a hidden, obscure necessity, a completely unmasked and unaccountable phenomenon. Or perhaps some idle and frivolous magician, there must be magicians in London, had cast a spell over me through his parlor window as I explored the maze of streets east and west in solitary leisurely walks without chart and compass. Till I began to write that novel I had written nothing but letters, and not very many of these. I never made a note of a fact, of an impression, or of an anecdote in my life. The conception of a planned book was entirely outside my mental range when I sat down to write. The ambition of being an author had never turned up amongst these gracious imaginary existences one creates fondly for oneself at times, in the stillness and immobility of a daydream. Yet it stands clear as the sun at noonday that from the moment I had done blackening over the first manuscript page of Lemaire's Folly, it contained about 200 words, and this proportion of words to a page has remained with me through the 15 years of my writing life. From the moment I had, in the simplicity of my heart and the amazing ignorance of my mind, written that page, the die was cast. Never had Rubicon been more blindly forded, without invocation to the gods, without fear of men. That morning I got up from my breakfast, pushing the chair back, and rang the bell violently, or perhaps I should say resolutely, or perhaps I should say eagerly, I do not know. But manifestly it must have been a special ring of the bell, a common sound made impressive, like the ringing of a bell for the raising of the curtain upon a new scene. It was an unusual thing for me to do. Generally, I dawdled over my breakfast, and I solemnly took the trouble to ring the bell for the table to be cleared away, but on that morning, for some reason hidden in the general mysteriousness of the event, I did not dawdle. And yet I was not in a hurry. I pulled the cord casually, and while the faint tinkling somewhere down in the basement went on, I charged my pipe in the usual way and I looked for the matchbox with glances distraught indeed but exhibiting, I am ready to swear, no signs of a fine frenzy. I was composed enough to perceive after some considerable time the matchbox lying there on the mantelpiece right under my nose. And all this was beautifully and safely usual. Before I had thrown down the match, my landlady's daughter appeared with her calm, pale face and an inquisitive look in the doorway. Of late it was the landlady's daughter who answered my bell. I mention this little fact with pride, because it proves that during the 30 or 40 days of my tenancy I had produced a favorable impression. For a fortnight past I had been spared the unattractive sight of the domestic slave. The girls in that Bessborough Gardens house were often changed, but whether short or long, fair or dark, they were always untidy, and particularly bedraggled, as if in a sordid version of the fairy tale the Ashman cat had been changed into a maid. I was infinitely sensible of the privilege of being waited on by my landlady's daughter. She was neatly anemic. "Will you please clear away all this at once?" I addressed her in convulsive accents, being at the same time engaged in getting my pipe to draw. This, I admit, was an unusual request. Generally on getting up from breakfast I would sit down in the window with a book, and let them clear the table when they liked, but if you think that on that morning I was in the least impatient, you are mistaken. I remember that I was perfectly calm. As a matter of fact, I was not at all certain that I wanted to write, or that I meant to write, or that I had anything to write about. No, I was not impatient. I lounged between the mantelpiece and the window, not even consciously waiting for the table to be cleared. It was 10 to 1 that before my landlady's daughter was done I would pick up a book and sit down with it all the morning in a spirit of enjoyable indolence. I affirm it with assurance, and I don't even know now what were the books then lying about the room. Whatever they were not the works of great masters, where the secret of clear thought and exact expression can be found. Since the age of 5 I have been a great reader, as is not perhaps wonderful in a child who was never aware of learning to read. At 10 years of age I had read much of Victor Hugo and other romantics. I had read in Polish and in French, history, voyages, novels. I knew Il Blas, and on Quixote in abridged editions. I had read in early boyhood Polish poets and some French poets, but I cannot say what I read on the evening before I began to write myself. I believe it was a novel, and it is quite possible that it was one of Anthony Trollope's novels. It is very likely. My acquaintance with him was then very recent. He is one of the English novelists whose works I read for the first time in English. With men of European reputation, with Dickens and Walter Scott and Thackeray, it was otherwise. My first introduction to English imaginative literature was Nicholas Nickleby. It is extraordinary how well Mrs. Nickleby could chatter disconnectedly in Polish, and the sinister Ralph Rage in that language. As to the Crummles family and the family of the learned Squeers, it seemed as natural to them as their native speech. It was, I have no doubt, an excellent translation. This must have been in the year 70. But I really believe that I am wrong. That book was not my first introduction to English literature. My first acquaintance was the Two Gentlemen of Verona, and that in the very MS of my father's translation. It was during our exile in Russia, and it must have been less than a year after my mother's death, because I remember myself in the black blouse with a white border of my heavy mourning. We were living together, quite alone, in a small house on the outskirts of the town of T that afternoon, instead of going out to play in the large yard which we shared with our landlord. I had lingered in the room in which my father generally wrote. What emboldened me to clamber into his chair I am sure I don't know, but a couple of hours afterwards he discovered me kneeling in it with my elbows on the table, and my head held in both hands over the MS of loose pages. I was greatly confused, expecting to get into trouble. He stood in the doorway looking at me with some surprise, but the only thing he said after a moment of silence was, "Read the page aloud." Luckily the page lying before me was not overblotted with erasures and corrections, and my father's handwriting was otherwise extremely legible. When I got to the end he nodded, and I flew out of doors thinking myself lucky to have escaped reproof for that piece of impulsive audacity. I have tried to discover since the reason of this mildness, and I imagine that all unknown to myself I had earned, in my father's mind, the right to some latitude in my relations with his writing table. It was only a month before, or perhaps it was only a week before, that I had read to him aloud from beginning to end, and to his perfect satisfaction, as he lay on his bed, not being very well at the time, the proofs of his translation of Victor Hugo's Oilers of the Sea. Such was my title to consideration, I believe, and also my first introduction to the sea in literature. If I do not remember where, how, and when I learned to read, I am not likely to forget the process of being trained in the art of reading aloud. My poor father, an admirable reader himself, was the most exacting of masters. I reflect proudly that I must have read that page of Woe Gentlemen of Verona tolerably well at the age of 8. The next time I met them was in A5's. One-volume edition of the dramatic works of William Shakespeare, read in Falmouth, at odd moments of the day, to the noisy accompaniment of Calker's mallets driving oakum into the deck seams of a ship in dry dock. We had run in a sinking condition, and with the crew refusing duty after a month of weary battling with the gales of the North Atlantic. Books are an integral part of one's life, and my Shakespearean associations are with that first year of our bereavement, the last I spent with my father in exile. He sent me away to Poland to my mother's brother directly he could brace himself up for the separation, and with the year of hard gales, the year in which I came nearest to death at sea, first by water, and then by fire. Those things I remember, but what I was reading the day before my writing life began I have forgotten. I have only a vague notion that it might have been one of Trollope's political novels. And I remember, too, the character of the day. It was an autumn day with an opaline atmosphere, a veiled, semi-opaque, lustrous day, with fiery points and flashes of red sunlight on the roofs and windows opposite, while the trees of the square with all their leaves gone were like tracings of Indian ink on a sheet of tissue paper. It was one of those London days that have the charm of mysterious amenity, of fascinating softness. The effect of opaline mist was often repeated at Bessborough Gardens on account of the nearness to the river. There is no reason why I should remember that effect more on that day than on any other day, except that I stood for a long time looking out of the window after the landlady's daughter was gone with her spoil of cups and saucers. I heard her put the tray down in the passage and finally shut the door, and still I remained smoking with my back to the room. It is very clear that I was in no haste to take the plunge into my writing life, if as plunge this first attempt may be described. My whole being was steeped deep in the indolence of a sailor away from the sea, the scene of never-ending labor and of unceasing duty. For utter surrender to indolence you cannot beat a sailor ashore when that mood is on him, the mood of absolute irresponsibility tasted to the full. It seems to me that I thought of nothing whatever, but this is an impression which is hardly to be believed at this distance of years. What I am certain of is that I was very far from thinking of writing a story, though it is possible, and even likely, that I was thinking of the man Elmayer. I had seen him for the first time some 4 years before from the bridge of a steamer moored to a rickety little wharf 40 miles up, more or less, a Bornean river. It was very early morning, and a slight mist, an opaline mist as in Bessborough Gardens only without the fiery flicks on roof and chimney pot from the rays of the red London sun, promised to turn presently into a woolly fog. Barring a small dugout canoe on the river there was nothing moving within sight. I had just come up yawning from my cabin. The Serang and the Malay crew were overhauling the cargo chains and trying the winches. Their voices sounded subdued on the deck below and their movements were languid. That tropical daybreak was chilly. The Malay quartermaster, coming up to get something from the lockers on the bridge, shivered visibly. The forests above and below and on the opposite bank looked black and dank. Wet dripped from the rigging upon the tightly stretched deck awnings, and it was in the middle of a shuddering yawn that I caught sight of Elmayer. He was moving across a patch of burnt grass, a blurred shadowy shape with the blurred bulk of a house behind him, a low house of mats, bamboos and palm leaves with a high-pitched roof of grass. He stepped upon the jetty. He was clad simply in flapping pajamas of cretonne pattern, enormous flowers with yellow petals on a disagreeable blue ground, and a thin cotton singlet with short sleeves. His arms, bare to the elbow, were crossed on his chest. His black hair looked as if it had not been cut for a very long time, and a curly wisp of it strayed across his forehead. I had heard of him at Singapore. I had heard of him on board. I had heard of him early in the morning and late at night. I had heard of him at tiffin and at dinner. I had heard of him in a place called Pulau Lot from a half-caste gentleman there, who described himself as the manager of a coal mine, which sounded civilized and progressive till you heard that the mine could not be worked at present because it was haunted by some particularly atrocious ghosts. I had heard of him in a place called Dongola, in the island of Celebes, when the Raja of that little known seaport you can get no anchorage there in less than 15 fathom, which is extremely inconvenient, came on board in a friendly way with only two attendants, and drank bottle after bottle of soda water on the after skylight with my good friend and commander, Captain C. At least I heard his name distinctly pronounced several times in a lot of talk in Malay language. Oh yes, I heard it quite distinctly. Elmer, Elmer, and saw Captain C smile, while the fat dingy Raja laughed audibly. To hear a Malay Raja laugh outright is a rare experience, I can assure you. And I overheard more of Almayer's name amongst our deck passengers, mostly wandering traders of good repute, as they sat all over the ship, each man fenced round with bundles and boxes on mats, on pillows, on quilts, on billets of wood, conversing of island affairs. Upon my word, I heard the mutter of Almayer's name faintly at midnight, while making my way aft from the bridge, to look at the patent taffrail log tinkling its quarter miles in the great silence of the sea. I don't mean to say that our passengers dreamed aloud of Elmer, but it is indubitable that two of them at least, who could not sleep apparently, and were trying to charm away the trouble of insomnia by a little whispered talk at that ghostly hour, were referring in some way or other to Elmer. It was really impossible on board that ship to get away definitely from Elmer, and a very small pony tied up forward, and whisking its tail inside the galley, to the great embarrassment of our Chinaman cook, was destined for Elmer. What he wanted with a pony goodness only knows, since I am perfectly certain he could not ride it. But here you have the man, ambitious, aiming at the grandiose, importing a pony, whereas in the whole settlement at which he used to shake daily his impotent fist, there was only one path that was practicable for a pony. A quarter of a mile at most, hedged in by hundreds of square leagues of virgin forest. But who knows? The importation of that Balai pony might have been part of some deep scheme, of some diplomatic plan, of some hopeful intrigue. With Almayer one could never tell. He governed his conduct by considerations removed from the obvious, by incredible assumptions, which rendered his logic impenetrable to any reasonable person. I learned all this later. That morning, seeing the figure in pajamas moving in the mist, I said to myself, "That's the man." He came quite close to the ship's side, and raised a harassed countenance, round and flat, with that curl of black hair over the forehead and a heavy, pained glance. "Good morning. Good morning." He looked hard at me. I was a new face, having just replaced the chief mate he was accustomed to see, and I think that this novelty inspired him, as things generally did, with deep-seated mistrust. "Didn't expect you until this evening," he remarked suspiciously. I don't know why he should have been aggrieved, but he seemed to be. I took pains to explain to him that having picked up the beacon at the mouth of the river just before dark and the tide serving, Captain C was enabled to cross the bar, and there was nothing to prevent him going upriver at night. "Captain C knows this river like his own pocket," I concluded discursively, trying to get on terms. "Better," said Elmer. Leaning over the rail of the bridge, I looked at Elmer, who looked down at the wharf in aggrieved thought. He shuffled his feet a little. He wore straw slippers with thick soles. The morning fog had thickened considerably. Everything round us dripped. The derricks, the rails, every single rope in the ship, as if a fit of crying had come upon the universe. Almayer again raised his head and in the accents of a man accustomed to the buffets of evil fortune asked hardly audibly, "I suppose you haven't got such a thing as a pony on board?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.